the place that published the romance, Harlequin Enterprises, that published all those romance novels for 3.5 years in the early 90s, which is why I learned everything there's to know but love. And I proofread 100 of them. No, I proofread for a year, and I copy-edited for 2.5 years, and I read altogether 200 of these Harlequin books, the romance ones, but also some of the action-adventure novels, which were very violent. And I learned a lot, as I say. And I was trying to remember last night at the reading a few of the lines that I kept. I kept a little notebook, my favorite lines. Maybe the best one was, she wrapped her arms around him and placed one hand upon each of his buttocks, male and female. So I'll let you work that one out. This is called The Dot Was Red. In 1992, I read how I could put a dot somewhere I looked a lot. And every time I looked at that dot, I would remember to... I worked at Harlequin Enterprises then, copy-editing romance novels. I lived in a tiny cubicle there, and I had a phone, and I had a computer, and I put a little sticker in the form of a red dot on my phone. I must have seen that dot several hundred times a day, and every time I saw it, I remembered to... If you would like further information about my tenure at Harlequin Enterprises, you can reference an old poem of mine called Around the Building, in which I talk about things that really happened and also things I made up. One thing I really liked about that job was bumping into Glenda at the subway station, where we both waited for the same bus. Glenda worked across the road for a record company. Plus, she wrote songs and played guitar, and she shared some of those songs with me. Glenda had red hair. We once went to see Kiss of the Spider Woman together. When we stepped off the bus, Glenda went to her building and I went to mine, where the first thing I saw when I reached my cubicle was the red dot. Immediately, I was reminded to... One guy we worked with had a party in his apartment. He invited all of us to come. He didn't have any food or drinks for his guests. There was half a chocolate cupcake in the fridge and he ate it. I went out to the store and bought 2 big bags of potato chips. I resented that he didn't reimburse me for them. At one point, some of us were out on his balcony, and he was inside, vacuuming his living room. At Harlequin, I edited 200 books about love and killing. The love books were temptations, romances, historicals, suspenses, desires. The books about killing were Mac Bolan, The Executioner, Deathlands. I developed crushes on 3 women at Harlequin and wanted to kill one man. I watched the York Mills bus pass by every 20 minutes on the street below. The dot on my phone was red. And I'm going to end with this. So a couple of these poems I'm reading, and I've not read out loud ever before. They say that the most important thing when you're writing poems, you must read them aloud. You must read them aloud so you get the sound. I never do that. For my 26th book, I will do that. My 26th book. So some years ago in 1999, I had filled with regret that I was publishing under the name Stuart Ross. And why did I not use my grandfather's Russian name, Rozovsky? Because that would be so much more distinctive and interesting. And so what I decided was the closest thing I could do was to create a character named Rozovsky, and Rozovsky would appear in many of my poems. And so Rozovsky's appeared in, I think, about 6 of my poetry books so far. And he sort of represents me or my father, my grandfather, these old guys with beards in these old photos from Russia from like 1894 and stuff. And there are 2 Rozovsky poems in this book, but also there's 1 Blatt poem. Blatt was my mother's father, Samuel Blatt. So I think there's going to start being more Blatt poems as well. But I'm going to read you a Rozovsky poem, Rozovsky in Paradise. And this is the last poem I'm reading. And again, thank you so much for being here, and thank you so much, and thank you so much. And there's, by the way, incredible baked goods here, and some cheese and stuff, and some wine back there. So as you're buying books, afterwards, you can, you should, or even if you're not, you should, punch down on some of that stuff. It's incredible. So thanks again so much. This is Rozovsky in Paradise. In the dark, Rozovsky settles into his seat. Around him, whispers the crumpling of wrappers, the scraping of feet. Music shakes the floor, and the screen explodes in a burst of lightning. Burt Lancaster, wearing only swimming trunks, presses his sinewy body against a door as rain pounds the terrible suburbs. He wraps his arm around his naked chest and sobs. Rozovsky didn't sleep so well last night. He rubs his eyes, then watches as Deborah Kerr walks slowly down a long hallway illuminated by the sputtering candle she holds before her. Her lips tremble as she braces for the cries of ghosts of children possessed by the devil. Rozovsky sinks further into his seat and pats his shirt pocket for cigarettes. Nothing. Terence Stamp stands over the motionless body of Samantha Egger, his dark eyes empty of emotion. He thought she'd come to love him. Outside the cinema, on the sidewalk, Rozovsky has forgotten it's still afternoon. The sun pries open his squinting eyes with a shoehorn his grandfather brought from Russia. Elizabeth Taylor comes to visit Montgomery Clift in his tiny jail cell. She says she will always love him, and he marches off to the chair. Rozovsky shoulders through the door of a cigar store, buys a Coke and cigarettes from a guy in a yarmulke. It's someone's yahrzeit tonight, but Rozovsky can't recall whose. He buys a candle. He'll remember later. He pops open the Coke cap on a newspaper box, takes a big gulp, and lights a Rothman's. Kim Novak stands in front of the painting of Carlotta Valdez. She's just left some flowers on the dead woman's grave, and now she's come to the gallery to gaze at her portrait. Rozovsky regards the yahrzeit candle in his hand. The soundtrack swells, and the candle turns into a ship. It's dark in the hold, just a few dim light bulbs swing gently, and Rozovsky strains to see all the faces, tired, pale, unwashed, and he hears whispers, quiet laughter, soft weeping. Soon he opens his eyes. A child whips by him on a bike. Playing cards slap in the spokes. Someone waves from a station wagon. A weeping willow sings like Enrico Caruso. A doorknob appears in Rozovsky's hand. He turns it. Thanks very much.
So much, Stuart. That was just wonderful, amazing. That concludes the reading. We'll give one more round of applause to Vera, Wanda, Sarah, and Stuart. Thank you so much.
And you just heard from a September book launch and reading event at Novel Idea Bookstore, readings by Stuart Ross. Sarah Moses, Wanda Promsma, Vera Hadzik, and emceed by Jason Haru. First of all, heartfelt thanks to all of you out there for tuning in to the first portion of the show today. Let's do this. I'll be right back.
Friday evenings at 6 p.m. here on CFRC, listen to Saltwater Music, a show covering all musical genres from the East Coast of Canada. Celtic, of course, but also rock, jazz, blues, folk, and a lot more. I'm your host, Rob Carnell. Tune in to Saltwater Music Friday evening from 6 to 8 here on CFRC 101.9 FM. Or you can catch us on the web at www.cfrc.ca. And for our listeners out east, that's 7 p.m. Atlantic and 7:30 Newfoundland.
Folk Everything is your passport to the finest in folk music. Old, new, and everything in between. The wonderful, the wild, and the weird.
Walk quietly by, he won't bother you. He's a busy man, he's got things to do.
It's all here Saturdays from 10 a.m. until 1 p.m. Folk Everything with Hugh on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston.
And you are and have been listening to Finding a Voice here on CFRC 101.9 FM. We are located in Lower Carruthers Hall, Queen's University, Kingston, Ontario. My name is Bruce. I'm here every Friday afternoon from 4 to 6 o'clock. We do stream live online as well at www.cfrc.ca. And just a quick reminder that every week, both hours of this show are uploaded to my personal blog space for it at Finding a Voice on cfrcfm.wordpress.com. And those do remain there for 3 years. Now continuing into the second hour, let's go ahead and just jump. It's quite a tight show today. So let's go ahead and jump into the next segment. And this will be from an October 8th event at Novel Idea Bookstore. You're going to hear Queen's University professor Mark Epricht both reading from and discussing his new book called Accidental Queer as he launched it there that evening. Here we go. Done.
So, I'm the author. I guess I'll introduce myself a bit later, just to save time. But first I'll do an acknowledgement. We're on the traditional lands of the Haudenosaunee and Anishinaabe people, but I also want to acknowledge the warm welcome that the people, the Shona people and the Basutu people and the Zulu people gave me. I wouldn't be here without the opportunity to live and work on their lands. And I wouldn't be at Queen's, actually, for that matter. So thank you for that. I'm also going to say thank you to Oscar and Novel Idea for hosting this event and for keeping this place alive through all the difficult times. And I'm going to thank two of my collaborators with the book, Francisco Miguel, who's not here, is a Brazilian anthropologist. A couple of interviews in the book are inspired by him. And Robert Morrell, who's my, in a way, a mentor, but he's also a close friend. I would describe him as a kind of the founder of critical masculinity studies in, well, in Southern Africa anyways. He also wrote a really nice introduction to the book, or preface, and I'll have to say the book wouldn't exist without him because I had written it, and I wrote to him and said, you know, Robert, you can tell me if this is a piece of shite, I'm not going to publish it. And he said, yeah, go for it. And so it wouldn't exist without him. I'm going to thank two special guests who are here. My great colleague, Rina Kukreja, professor in development studies. And she's actually going to be a discussant. She's going to say a few words. Whatever you feel like is great. So Rina is a wonderful colleague and a fantastic scholar and a film documentary filmmaker and anti-racism activist, I would say. Is fantastic. It's an honor that you agreed to do this. And I'm going to thank one other special invited guest is the artist who did this is here. It's right here. And her Facebook is in here if you want to get a tattoo. Going to be one of the only tattoo artists in Kingston with a Bachelor of Fine Arts. So there you go. Welcome. Thank you, Jennifer Grant. And I'll just explain that too because I'll explain the cover. So the cover is, this is actually me. Stylized version of me in 1979 Pan American Games. I was a gymnast for about 9 years or something like that, and at that time I was getting my political consciousness and growing from being a boy to a man with limited awareness of the world. And actually, I remember very clearly I was on the way to a competition, and someone was reading the newspaper. It was June of 1976. And so my gymnastics career overlapped with the Soweto uprising, and probably some of you heard about that. And I was like, what is going on with that? So it started to make me think about the world in a really interesting way. So I actually gave a real picture to Jen and said, you know, just stylize that somehow and show me thinking about Africa. She came up with this kind of psycho Africa, which is closer to the way I ultimately feel about it. So thank you all. I'm just going to say one more thing. I do hope you buy the book. I had a crazy idea that I really want to support this kind of radical, small publishing house in Africa, Cameroon. And so I went with them. They're really good. They helped me get to the place and did this and all, everything. Yeah. And then at the end, I never even thought about this. What is the price going to be? So unfortunately, I found out when I went to order my author's copy, it's pretty expensive. So I'm a bit sorry about that. Not one single cent is coming to me. It's all going to, I don't know, the publisher in Africa. I'm sure our host here will take whatever, you know, to cover the cost of the wine and cheese. And the rest is going to support students who are doing research on gender and sexuality topics in Africa. So I do hope you buy it, but I'm sorry how expensive it is. Okay, so introduction of me, I'm going to be really short. So I'm a professor at Queen's University in Global Development Studies. Been there for a few years. I'm a historian by training. I will explain the cover. I did already. I'm going to explain the title too. I should do that. And then I'm going to do a very short reading too, just because that's traditionally what you do at these events. But the title, so Accidental Queer, and I'll also explain why I wrote this. I mean, well, why I wrote it, I wanted to write outside the box of usual academic writing. I've been doing that for quite a long time, and you feel you throw stuff out there and nobody reads it, sort of thing. A few people do, and whatever. But it feels like, oh, no, I want to write something different. And this was from long before. Before COVID, I started thinking of this, and my parents were kind of dying, and thinking, oh, maybe I can reflect on some aspects of my life and growing up with them and all that. So that was before COVID. COVID happened. My big research project, well, also a vast insurrection in the place where my research project was based, and that all sort of fell apart at the same time, and made me start thinking about, you know, reflecting on all the years I've been going to Africa, which is about 40 years, actually 40 years this year. And so just after I finished this, I went to Zimbabwe, and so maybe I'll reflect on all that work and the changes that have happened and where next, kind of thing. So that's how I started writing it. Now the title, Accidental Queer, it's one of essays. So there's 9 essays in the book. Well, they're not all essays. Some are more like stories. And so it's kind of a hybrid. There's also, you know, a couple of interviews and some more, I don't know, serious academic kind of engagement with the scholarship on various topics, including 2 courses that I taught at Queen's, one of which where we sat with on tourism. I've been thinking about tourism for a long time and ethics and change that sort of need to happen in that industry, which employs 10% of the world's population, right? So it's not going to go away. So I have a chapter on that and a chapter on HIV/AIDS. I taught a course here for a long time on that. And other stuff in here. Anyway, so it's essays, stories, a little bit of memoir. Rena can respond to it however she feels like. But the title, Accidental Queer, is one of the essays, because of all the work I've done, probably that got the most attention. And it's not an accident. I don't identify as queer in a conventional sense, and the word is used. And I didn't have a plan to do the research that got attention subsequently. On the contrary, not at all. I'd arrived in Zimbabwe in 1995 without any plan. I was hired at the UZ to teach as a junior lecturer and thought, okay, something will emerge, whatever. The week later, the president starts denouncing gays and lesbians as if, you know, they're enemies of the people, right? They're avatars of Western colonialism. I thought, wow, okay, that sounds like a good research project. Why don't I test that out to see if it's true? And then one thing led to the other, right? So it was, it's not exactly accidental, but serendipitous that one thing followed the other. And I really loved that Karen was there when Judith Byfield came up and she talked about serendipity as part of the historical method, you know, and it's not, I always thought this is just happening to me. What is going on? But Judith, and there's a whole scholarship on that. I followed up. It's like you make serendipity happen. If that is not an oxymoron, and I feel that might have happened a little bit. Anyways, so that's one of the chapters or essays. it's explaining how I got in there and step by step. And some of the personalities I want to honor, a lot of them died in the meantime from various things. Not the thing you might expect from Southern Africa. None of the people I know and closely collaborated with died of that particular transmissible disease. But other things. So they're kind of gone, and I'm reflecting on them as well and honoring the work that they did. So that's that. And what else was I going to do? I was going to do a short reading. Yes, okay. And I asked Rena, what do you think would be a good reading to do out of this? They're pretty diverse. I mean, there's HIV/AIDS, there's tourism, there's methodological. I mean, I'm being interviewed by an anthropologist who wants to talk to a historian, and it's kind of fun. And then talking about the actual history, knowledge production, step by step, Lesotho, Zimbabwe, South Africa, etc. So it's quite diverse. Everywhere I presented this, this is the first in Canada, by the way. I did a number in South Africa, which was really fantastic. Everyone was completely different all over the place. So I asked Lena, what do you think would be good for Kingston? She said that tourism, Kingston, whatever. And so, yeah, sure, I'll do that. Some of the sections of that chapter are a bit personally embarrassing. So I'm going to skip over those. Yeah,
but you can buy the book. Get to read them.
I mean, this chapter I really enjoyed writing because I'm combining some storytelling about tourism. Was a big part of my growing up and going from being a boy to a man with no consciousness of the world particularly, and then acquiring political consciousness, not through tourism exactly. So the chapter is called The Confessions of an Anti-Tourist. Because I never ever, I think, and I look back on my whole life, almost no trip, or I could count on this hand, that I'm going to pay to go somewhere to have a holiday. It almost never happened, although there were a few little camping trips we did. Yeah. Jennifer's my daughter, by the way. I don't think I said that. Yeah, we did camping around Zimbabwe and that sort of thing. But, you know, to go somewhere, I think there's one or two. It was always something else tacked on. So I never had that consciousness of, oh, I'm a tourist. But I did enjoy all the perks and wonders of tourism through my work and through the sport. I was a gymnast, so a lot of my travel, I went to Cuba as a gymnast. Actually, it was one of the transformative experiences I speak about in the book. Learning about different ways of looking at the world. So all that was... So I have very positive feelings about tourism, but also I'm deeply concerned about some of the things that are going on. So this chapter makes us some personal reflections with the scholarship, thinking how we are going to get to the next stage, right? We have to change the way tourism is done. And there's hundreds of billions of dollars invested in going back to the status quo ante, right? So how are we going to think through that? So anyways, I'll just do a short reading. I hope it's, Rena, you flag me when if it's going on too long, but I think it's just a couple of pages, and I'll skip over one embarrassing part. but up to this point in the chapter, I'm talking about tourism as a way of me becoming a man. So that's the theme of the book that unites the essays, masculinity. What does that mean? How do you learn to become a man? Because it isn't a natural phenomenon, right? It's not an essential thing. You learn it. And so I talk about, you know, my parents trying to teach me. They were immigrants to Canada, right? They're trying to teach me how to be a good North American. Don't think they were so keen on Canada when they I think they wanted to go to the States when I first came here. But they wanted to teach me to be a good North American. And then I had my gymnastics and then my development work. I was a teacher in Zimbabwe and this and that. And then my academic life. So I'm working that through. And then I engage with the scholarship on how people are thinking about changing it up a bit. So a lot of this, there's a kind of phase in there between gymnastics and when I became an academic and got married and had family and all that. I was trying to test my masculinity through travel. Like, how can I be a man by suffering, more or less, right? by doing crazy traveling and this and that. So I'll just read a portion of that. It's kind of funny in retrospect, but anyways, and maybe you don't find it funny. I'll start on this one. One test of my masculinity trip I thankfully failed. I was booked to leave for Zimbabwe at the end of August, that eventful year of 1984, leaving Alison behind, and didn't thank Alison, but I should now be late to be. leaving Alison behind for a few months. Young lovers trying to figure things out under pressure of such a deadline can be a recipe for tension. Sure enough, about 3 weeks to go before my departure, we had a big fight. Exasperated, I announced I would be hitchhiking to Vancouver to cool down. 1 week to get there, one to get back, one to renew our passion before my flight. Fine, she said, go. Things were going well until London, Ontario, when this older guy picked me up. For 2 hours, he described how fun it was to live in Windsor, because you could just go across to Detroit any old time. Bathhouses, he elaborated. You should try. I said, maybe next time. He gave me more details. I can get out here, actually, Adam, if you don't mind. Your loss. Turns out, going over to Detroit was not as easy as he had led me to believe. At the border, the U.S. immigration dude wore reflector shades. He looked me up and down. My backpack, my baby face. Boy, he finally intoned, just where do you think you're going? I kid not. He was on secondment from Mississippi. Vancouver, I enthusiastically replied. I'm taking a shortcut across your beautiful country. No, you are not. I spluttered something about having a job lined up in Zimbabwe while digging out my credit card. He was scribbling something on a piece of paper, which he then handed back to me without a glance at my financial bona fides. Take this here, over to there. That there is the bus back through the tunnel. Enjoy your trip. In retrospect, that cracker did me two big favors. One, it was dusk, and walking into downtown Detroit in the mid-1980s may have been a mistake for a white lad with a lost look on his baby face. Two, in attempting to make up the lost time retracing my step to get on the All-Canada Route West, I pushed my luck, hitching long into the night. The first lift was great, 4 straight hours back to Toronto. Getting dropped off at the intersection of 2 of the busiest highways in the country, in the rain, in the dark, was not so great. But I was not yet ready to swallow my pride and hop on the subway back to Allison's place. No, that came the next day, when I was stuck on the verge of Highway 69 outside Parry Sound for 8 hours. 8 stinking hours in the broiling sun and not one lift. 24 hours since departure, and I was exactly 242 kilometers from my starting point. Only 8,000 or so left to go. I finally yelled. That's not actually what I wrote in the book. Finally, I yelled aloud to the trees and mosquitoes. I walked into town, bought a bus ticket, a couple of beers, and headed back south. So, I'm just going to skip here now. So Alice and I worked things out, and then we moved to the next stage, development work. So the tourism component here was constrained by a subsistence level salary and the anti-apartheid boycott of South Africa. In those days, though, you could move around quite a lot elsewhere in the region on a low budget. Having a white skin was a definite asset. It was not long after the war for Zimbabwe's independence, and the local whites, the losers, were still eager to get their story out. Indeed, roadies were often extremely generous in picking us up from the side of the road, sharing their opinions, and sometimes putting us up for the night. One farmer offered us the keys to his fishing shack on the Zambezi. Just put them in the gum boots behind the shack when you leave, and watch out for the crocs. Black drivers could also be relied upon to give a lift eventually, although in my experience they tended to pick you up because they needed help with the cost of the petrol, or they wanted to convert you to their church. Anyways, maybe I'm just going to end on that point, and I'm going to hand it over to one. There's really some funny stories here, but do buy the book. It's going to be a good cause, and Rena, you do your thing.
Keep sounding good. So much, Mark. I came to know Mark and Allison. I need to tell this because it's a memoir of his, and I have to tell you how I've actually come to know him better through his book. I thought I knew him, but no, I did not. I have known him a bit more better and come to respect him voluminously because of what he has written about his ethics. So I met him first and Allison at a dinner at Bruce and Elaine Sperman's. If Allison might remember that meeting, and that's where I got to know you when I think you just come into town. This was like maybe 24, 25 years ago, maybe. Yeah, you were fresh then. So I'm really honored that you asked me to be a discussant because I've admired your work and I know how much my colleagues admire your work. Just to give a context, this past November, I had invited scholars, queer scholars from Northern Europe to come in to give a talk on queer utopias. And I was showing them around the department. They stopped in front of an office. And then, like reverentially, Mark Ebrecht teaches here. He's your colleague. We love his works. And they knew all his works much more than I do, which embarrassed me no end. I'm sorry. So I do want to see my role as a discussant, not by elaborating on the good qualities per se, but just pointing out some amazing stuff, but also to ask him questions to explain more, because those are my questions that I feel would be left answered. He's always writing, he's zipping around, busy. So I thought this is a good opportunity to nail him down, if that's okay. And then also to maybe read us something else as well. Why not? Okay. So, I mean, when I read this book, and I would urge you to read it too, is I saw it as an evolution of a young boy growing up in a very kind of a conservative household, conservative Canada, and then a kind of a willful transformation that Mark brought upon himself. Whether looking at the world, walking away from gymnastics as a sport because of what it was, but also looking at what masculinity as ethos was doing to him. Right? Correct me if I'm wrong. So it's a kind of a, yeah, it's a whole process of de-learning, right? Which I found really fascinating. And it's also a study for me in terms of research ethics. I was telling Mark earlier today, actually the whole book could be used for methods, for research methods, about how we work with people, about, yes, serendipity that happens, but also learning the art of listening, of acknowledging different forms of knowledge production, of knowledge skill sets, of navigating through the morass of our own biases, which I found really interesting. And that's why I was telling him that cow patty example is really a great one, right? And there's countless other examples, which I just appreciate. In the introductory chapter, Mark talks about the imperative for, of course, this the whole book is bound by masculinity, whether we're looking at anti-tourism, whether we're looking at AIDS and poverty, or even the courses that were designed. But in the introductory chapter, you talk about the imperative for decolonization of masculinity, decolonization of hegemonic masculinity. So I was curious, especially, you know, can you speak a bit more about it and how that relates to the work on masculinities done by African or South African scholars that are showing, and to quote your own words, a healing praxis, right? I mean, you quote that in the chapter on Lesotho, that, you know, they're saying, get your shit together, man. So how do you do it when the structural forces are so relentless? How do you get your act together about decolonizing masculinity when all of what we are faced with is so hyper-masculinized? I mean, and those are some questions that I found really interesting to tease out as I read, whether it's anti-tourism. And I found my answers in the cliff, but I want to hear more from you. And again, the book reads to be a gentle guide, as I said, about research methods, And fieldwork, how to learn from mistake, lose the romantic gaze. And that really spoke close home to me, particularly, right? Especially as quite often we travel out to do research in the global south. And how you see research or research interactions that might have been done differently, and that happens through hindsight. And it's time plus experience, right? It doesn't happen in the moment. I know that. And one last question, and I've written, I would love you to share the story of the three women about methods, right? I mean, and those are interesting learning moments for all of us about how we take something as being accepted. One last question. In your chapter, Confessions of an Anti-Tourist, you discuss the evolution of the course, and then you take a critical look at tourism. And it stems partly from your own, largely from your own travels that you describe as, quote, "I'm not a tourist because I have to travel for work." This is something that I'm very familiar. We all do that, right? And it strikes again very close to me. And you say anti-tourism is masculinist, and I'd like you to explain a bit more about that. Or was that, yeah, am I correct? I think you did say anti-tourism as masculinist, or tourism as masculinist, sorry, yes.
They're flip-flop.
Yes, flip both, yeah, because you did that, right? And I'm curious, as a person who's diasporic, but with families located transnationally, how do we reconcile the resolve, the guilt for traveling given climate change? Because as Sunera Thavani says, there are some people who become exalted subjects because of the politics of their location, whereas others face a kind of guilting because of the travel that they do. I mean, and so those are my thoughts. I mean, those are my more questions, but I feel that this discussion could go as a Q&A where we get to know more. So maybe begin by anti-tourism and then go backwards.
Right. Okay, so there was a lot in there.
I loved reading your book, by the way. It kept me up two straight nights.
Oh, that's great. Well, thank you so much. That's really sweet of you to say. The anti-tourism thing, just to make it short and sweet, there's a kind of snobbery, basically, there, and it's an assertion of privilege to say that I'm not one of the dirty ignoramuses traveling around there in the tour bus. But I'm going to the same places, I'm consuming the same things, it's just in a different style. And that style is, I would have to reflect, you know, an assertion of privilege, that I, as a white man, was able to go places without fear that, other people might encounter. Completely unconscious of that. And one of the stories, maybe I'll quickly read that too. Actually, I was going to get that far, but I didn't want to go too. But because this was a kind of epiphany moment for me, and this I think.
Is that the one where you're living straight by the highway?
No, the most affordable accommodation in Southern Africa. Uh-huh. Yes. So traveling on the cheap, right, and doing it the macho way is basically was the theme from the beginning, not from the gymnastics days, but it, even there was, you know. Because the team would do their thing, and I would break myself away and go do something dangerous, like black market trading and that kind of stuff. There would always have to be one step up. And when I think about a black market in Romania in 1979, I think back, it's dumb, right? Why was I doing that? Jumping over a fence in a... No. It was too much. So there was this assumed right that as a white man I can go and do anything I want, basically, and completely oblivious to that. But I did get the memo eventually, and then here's the story, I guess. I finally got the memo when I realized I was putting Allison in danger. The first clue should have been the motel sign that read, impressively, "The most affordable accommodation in Southern Africa!" Yep. We stayed the night for 200 rands, then about 25 bucks, because I wanted to be close to the Johannesburg airport. We would so we'd be sure to get the early morning flight to Oribi. I still did not have a smartphone, since I was clearly smart enough to figure things out myself. It was dusk when we set out from Vitz, but traffic was heavy. Sure enough, I made the wrong turn getting out the highway, maybe two. Utterly lost and getting flustered, I saw the most affordable sign and a couple of reassuring late model 4x4s in the parking lot. Hey, if they can stay there, so could we in our little rental Kia. Not much sleep was had, but we did make the flight out, and I clocked the lesson. At 55 years old, with a professor's salary, I did not need to stay in a totally unknown area, no bars on window, sirens howling, cul-de-sac, with no place to eat or even get a cup of tea. That decision was a legacy, I realized, of an old toxic masculinity. And then, to quote a scholar here, where did that go? I like the way she put it. Anti-tourism. Kristen Lozanski writes mm-hmm. about this. Idealized travel, as opposed to tourism, which is predicated upon a successful negotiation of risk, and as such, gendered privilege and racial privilege. And this was like, sort of why I started the course. To not to atone for my bad behavior and the risks. I'm sorry, I put you through some of this too. that's to answer your question. Yeah. Mm. And if I can respond to one more thing, because it's part of the learning process too, my first book, The Photographs, and this was fun to realize this, but deeply shocking to me. My first book was on the history of women and gender in Lesotho, and part of it, you know, I did all the archive stuff and then this and that, and then I went to the archives of Catholic Mission, which was running the show in Lesotho. They're mostly Quebecers over there. They owned the place for a long time. And all the archives were there in Ottawa. So I went there and I was looking for photographs. So most of the photographs are terrible. You know, some priest would say, everybody line up 30 meters away from the camera so we can't see your face. I don't know. They were terrible photos. I was going through. Oh, I can't use any of this. And then this one beautiful photo shows up, and three beautiful women, African women, and I said, I'm taking that one, and it's going to be on my book. So about two decades later, I was passing through Switzerland on my way to Africa, and this friend says, you know, I've been wondering about that photo of your book. I've seen it before. No. It came from there. I know the mission. I can give you the date and the exact place it came from. And then anyways, another couple of years passed, and I came back and said, I found it. So he found the photo. The guy's a fanatic. He was trying to track me down. He said, no, I found this photo. It was from German Southwest Africa, so at least 20 years before, I thought it was, and a couple of thousand kilometers away. So, and then he said, well, you know, just because the photo is in the file that you think it was, it doesn't mean who put it there, whatever. It was a big lesson in being more careful about looking at stuff. And I think that resonates now, and part of the reason I enjoyed speaking to Francisco, the Brazilian anthropologist, as a young guy, some of the things we take for granted as older people, you know, the archives, we can trust somewhat what's in there. We can't, as I just showed. But nowadays, with so much stuff on electronic platforms, the need for vigilance is just ramped up 1,000 times. So, So, anyways, thanks for asking that.
No, but it also creates more, like with digitization, AI, it creates even more worries and concerns about what knowledge can be manipulated, right? Because you're talking, it's a cautionary tale about not accepting what is there, but questioning the veracity. What is it really, right? I mean, in that sense, how do you acquire knowledge? So do you think, I mean, it's a larger question about, does technology really give you that freedom? But coming back, I want to ask you about decolonizing masculinity. That's a big project. How do you envision it?
Yeah, I don't have any answers. I'll tell you that right from the start.
There's nothing in here. But I want to hear.
Everyone's going to have a different path. and some people can go the Christian route. I don't know whatever they need to do. For me personally, I've written about, and the last chapter is a little bit about that, comes from, to a certain extent, you know, some of the theorization that's happening with First Nations people here resonates with me a lot, and I live here, and so I want to listen to what they're saying. Glenn Coulthard has got this expression, the grounded normativity. I kind of like that, which I just understand is, you know, normativity. You should be grounded in the place you live. So decisions you make should reflect some relationship with you have the place. And so for me, my last chapter is trying to bring this stuff together. It's called The Cliff. And Jen knows The Cliff. So where I live, there's an 8-meter drop-off. It used to be,
a quarry,
yeah. So, I mean, half of downtown Kingston came from there. And then when that finished, people turned it into a dump. And they just threw everything off. It's unbelievable. You're living beside the most beautiful place in the world. There's a national park out there. And people just threw the garbage off the side of the cliff. So since we've been living there, one of my things is to go down there and pull stuff out. And some of it's not easy. Some of it's easier than others. There was a big television set down there, you know, the old kind, that big with a... Someone just put that down there. Can you imagine? Oil tank, bicycles, tires, all that stuff. So it's kind of, that's my kind of, it's a different kind of yoga, I guess, if you want to put it that. It's a kind of meditation. And it makes me angry, to the first step, because why did people do that? Hiding stuff, like a little cave with oil cans in. Really? Why did you do that? What kind of mentality was it? But when I get through that anger, I feel a big connection and a positivity. So that's my kind of, that's my yoga. And when, you know, you and the other kids inherit it, it's going to be cleaner than it was before. So that's that. So that doesn't do anything about the big picture, right? The big picture, though, and I think the methodology stuff, we can think about as we make decisions, you know, and that's the ethics of the travel, and why did I do this research and why not, and how do I relate to colleagues. That's also part of it. But in a way, I don't think that other stuff, for me, can really happen except by this, not exactly daily, but often interaction with the place that I live.
And also with humans, right? I mean, learning that toxic or hegemonic masculinity also stems from the kind of interactions we have with our family, with people as friends, but also you chose to willfully walk away from that in many ways, like joining a men's group in Edmonton, which I found really interesting and loving way, you know. You talk about, yeah, you needed to unlearn some of the behaviors and choosing a more kind of caring masculinity, which is now being articulated as caring masculinity, but I see that through and through. I mean, caring not just towards your partner, but towards the land, towards other people that you're working with. So that is a process, right? It's not, it's a deliberate process that you undertake.
Yes. It has to be deliberate and committed. It's not going to happen by pressing a button. And the men's group thing, I did write about that a little bit in here. It was a very important part of it. To be with a group of men similarly committed to trying to change the way they are as men in the world. So these are all heterosexual white men, but different professions, different level of education, but all working towards that goal of we want to be better people in this world, despite everything we learned as boys and the whole society is telling us to be this way. So it was a group committed to that. So there's a lot of men's groups that are out there that are really toxic, and the majority probably are terrible. But I was lucky with this particular, well, not purely lucky.
No, you know, you had the leader, remember?
I had to fight because there were some toxic leftovers in the group, and we had to, you know, democratically and this and that to kind of purge. So it was a great a great experience. So yes, it takes a commitment, and it's not finished, right? It never ends, since the culture is so insidious, you can hardly even know what's there half the time.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, I'll just end by asking one question, and I think people might have more. I mean, I was curious. I really like how you're coming back a full circle and giving back to the community by volunteering at HARS. But you also write in, again, the chapter on HIV/AIDS, that scholars in Southern Africa or Africa are choosing not to engage with it, despite the epidemic being there, right? And you also did not do that. And I understand the reasons, because you do talk about it later. So I just want to know, is that not then undermining attention by saying, you know, maybe there are other pressing issues? I'm just curious about your reflections to give, you know, just some more insights about, yes, I can understand, because it'll repeat the whole scenario, the paradigm or the stereotype that, yes, Africa is riddled with HIV/AIDS, but also totally silencing it is also, I don't know. I'm just curious to hear more about it from you.
Right. So I have a chapter on that. I'm not silencing it, but I had to make that choice, because that is the way things are going. It's being normalized as if it's like diabetes or something, that everyone just get used to it. But there's 7 million plus people living with this drug that's imported, and it is toxic, and it's not just one drug. There's so many things. How can you not talk about this? And it's not just the economics of it and the all the social aspects of it. There's I do have a section on it. You know, there's metaphysical things that we need to think about. Witchcraft is in there. Mm-hmm. How can we not talk about that? Because it's terrible. And for us, and I think one of my points is, and I take this on personally, is like, you don't want to talk about that. You don't want to feed into the Afro-pessimism and all this. And I don't. But putting your head in the sand is not helping either, right? So I talk, in that chapter, I talk mostly about what other people are saying.
Yes.
I don't know what to do about it, except not put my head in the sand and say, this is going on. And, you know, mm-hmm. wiser people can think of a way forward. But it's terrible. It's not diabetes, right? And it's changing, right? It's not stable. So who knows what's coming next, right? So that's what I'm saying there.
No, I get it. But yeah, I just wanted to hear, I want people to understand also, the imperative for you to write that, because everyone is erasing it. It's like airbrushing it out of existence, right?
Especially, and here in Kingston too, that's the thing.
Precisely.
And this, like, although it's interesting to me in the work I do with HARS, or it's now Trellis, HIV/AIDS Regional Service work. I mean, I'm a volunteer, I don't do much, but I'm there and I see the people come in, and probably 95% of the people who come in, it's not for HIV at all. It's for food. So here in Kingston, that's what people need. They can get the drugs if they have the virus, but most of them don't. So they're coming for food, and that's it. And that's in Kingston. So, and we just had this event, you know, a couple of weeks ago or whatever, and those people are scattered all over the place now who were at that encampment.
Mm-hmm.
Where are they? They found other encampments. They're in the bush. And, so it's. I think that's the other thing I want to make in that chapter, is it's not just a faraway thing.
Yes.
It's here too, in a different, you know, manifestation, but it's still, yeah. Anyways, thank you.
Yeah, and thank you for giving me this opportunity.
And you just heard Queen's University professor Mark Eprecht at Novel Idea reading from and discussing his new book, Accidental Queer. It is 54 and a half minutes after 5 o'clock. My heartfelt thanks to all of you today for having tuned in to the show, and an equal thanks to all the readers featured today, and also to Novel, as always, Novel Idea Bookstore for their time and space. You are and have been listening to Finding a Voice here on CFRC 101.9 FM. We are located in Lower Carruthers Hall, Queen's University, Kingston, Ontario. My name is Bruce. Here every Friday afternoon from 4 to 6 o'clock. We do stream live online as well at www.cfrc.ca. And just a reminder again, both hours of this show are uploaded to my personal blog space for the show at Finding a Voice on cfrcfm.wordpress.com. They do remain there for 3 years. I would also encourage you to stay tuned at the top of the hour for two hours of East Coast music in a show called Saltwater Music, hosted by Rob Carnell. And I did mention our website, www.cfrc.ca. Please go there, and I wish I had more time to talk about it again in this hour. I did in the first hour, but go to that site and click on the icon or that rolling screen at the top of our homepage, and the one that says Funding Drive. Click on that. Have a great week, everybody.
Hello, CFRC listeners. This is Christina Laurie, CFRC's Local Journalism Initiative news reporter. CFRC's annual Funding Drive campaign is now underway through December 31st, and you can help CFRC keep our listeners informed on issues that matter with modernized broadcasting equipment and trained team members. Help CFRC hit our $25,000 fundraising goal this year by donating today at cfrc.ca.
On Saturday, November 30th, the Independent Wrestling Academy, in cooperation with CFRC 101.9 FM, presents IWA Wrestling School of Rock. A portion of the proceeds from this family-friendly professional wrestling event will be donated directly to CFRC's annual funding drive. Tickets are available for $20 and can be bought through iwacanada.ca. The event is scheduled to take place at the Upper Hall of the Spire on 82 Sydenham Street. Doors at 5 p.m., opening bell will be at 5:30. Be sure to check out cfrc.ca and iwacanada.ca for additional event details. We hope to see you there, and we hope you're ready to rock the Spire.
Late in the 1970s, four Kingston women got together to discuss the idea of creating a community house, a place where grassroots organizations, families, and groups could gather, a place where food could be prepared and shared, new skills could be learned, and lively discussion could be encouraged. For over 30 years, Kingston Community House has provided low-cost meeting space for hundreds of groups, allowing people to come together to learn from one another, share resources, and trade skills. As it becomes safe once again to gather in person, we look forward to providing the Kingston community with a comfortable and convenient place to reconnect with one another. Located in downtown Kingston, we operate 7 days a week. For more information on Kingston Community House and how to book, please visit kingstoncommunityhouse.org.
Join us here on CFRC on November 11th for an afternoon and early evening in honor of Sheila Rogers, Queen's University's 16th Chancellor. Listen to the convocation ceremony in Grant Hall that will include her official installation as Chancellor starting at 2:30 p.m. and then join in the fun wherever you are in the world for the Chancellor's installation reception, broadcasting live from the Isabel Bader Center for the Performing Arts from 5:30 to 7 p.m., featuring outstanding Chancellor-curated music and engaging speakers such as the Principal of Queen's, the Rector, and the Chancellor herself. We look forward to celebrating with you on November 11th. Learn more on the Queen's Chancellor installation webpage. This is our life.
CFRC 101.9 FM has new social media. Find us on Instagram and Facebook at CFRC Music and keep up with the latest announcements about our programming and projects. Follow us today at CFRC Music.